Hi everyone, and welcome to this new edition of the Corporate Chat Podcast. Your two hosts for today are Mathis Grandchamp and myself, Emile Jolnet. We're both pursuing a bachelor in commerce and majors in finance. Special thanks to Red Bull for sponsoring the show. Our guest today is Ilya Friesen, Managing Director at Millicent Company, a global investment bank. Mr. Friesen holds a Bachelor of Arts from Western University and an MBA from Columbia Business School. Prior to working at Millicent, Mr. Friesen also acquired valuable experience in the field, working in major Canadian banks such as Scotiabank and RBC. During this episode, Mr. Friesen delved into his career and shared valuable knowledge on his field of expertise, the hospitality and leisure sector. Without further ado, here is a conversation with Ilya Friesen.
All right, Ilya, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen.
So let's kick off the interview and dive into your past. You graduated from Ivy Business School at Western in 2002. What made you want to pursue a career in finance?
So I think there's a lot of reasons why I and other people want to pursue a career in finance. First of all, it's a very dynamic industry. It's constantly changing. It's very fast-paced. It's diverse. When you say you work in finance, that could mean any one of a number of things, from private wealth management to investment banking to private equity to working in some type of market role to working in corporate finance at a corporation. So there's a lot of different ways you can work in finance, and that creates a lot of opportunities as well, right, to further your career. It's constantly fast-paced, almost no matter what job within that broad spectrum you decide to choose, and there's constant learning. I learn every day on the job. I learn every deal on the job. I'm constantly trying to improve my skills. And I would say it opens doors to other industries, right? It's very easy to move from finance, you know, to a corporate role, right? Still staying within finance or into, you know, a senior leadership position. And then finally, you know, finance sort of intersects with politics pretty closely. So you're constantly thinking of how does public policy interact with your profession and frankly, interacting with political leaders. There's a reason why Eric Cantor works at Moelis and is our vice chairman and is incredibly effective in that role because he brings such a unique policy perspective to the company.
Right. You now work in investment banking, right? But you didn't start your career in investment banking after your bachelor's degree. How did you manage to break into investment banking, given that a traditional path typically involves securing a return offer from a summer internship during undergraduate studies?
That's a great question. And the first thing I would say is, you know, it wasn't easy 20 years ago. I think it's even more challenging now to break in if you're not taking the traditional path. But I would have a couple of pieces of advice for people, right? I had a somewhat unique path to get there. But the keys are, one, continue networking. Always be networking. Every conversation you have could be the path to a new opportunity. And by the way, I think you should think of that advice throughout your life, right? Every interaction you have, someone could become a client, a potential business partner. You never know. Think of your network. Think of your personal network. Think of your school network. In your guys' case, think of the McGill network. In my case, it was the Western network. And you got to take a very broad approach to recruiting, right? There's a certain number of companies and banks that are going to come to campus, right? They are a small fraction of the total number of opportunities that are out there. So you can't just rely on, although for many people it works out very well, you can't just rely on campus recruiting. You got to do your own research. You got to find your own opportunities. And that's what I did.
And you were an investment banking analyst at Scotiabank in 2007. What motivated you to pursue an MBA at that point in your career?
Well, there was a couple of reasons. First of all, I'd been out of undergrad for 5 years, felt like the right time. I'd been an analyst for at Scotia in my prior firm for, 3.5 years. I was sort of ready to take a break or do something different. I wanted to improve my skills. I was already part of the Ivy Network, which is a very powerful network in Canada, but I wanted to be part of a different network, and that was the Columbia Network, and I wanted to be in New York. And I felt that just was, you know, Columbia Business School was the right opportunity for me, the right sort of mix of classroom and practical training, and the right opportunity to learn from sort of industry leaders that worked in New York. So for me, it was a logical decision as sort of the next step in my career.
You also graduated your MBA at Columbia during the financial crisis. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and the challenges it presented?
So I would say for myself, it was frankly a blessing in disguise, but I'll say for a lot of people I know, it was very challenging and frankly had long lasting impacts on their careers. Why do I say it was a blessing in disguise? So we were, you know, I was at Columbia Business School from 2007 to 2009, right through basically the entire financial crisis. But the opportunity to hear again from professors that were sort of involved actively in what was going on at the time. As example, Frederick Mishkin, a former Fed governor, was a professor of mine. And every week he'd come in with insights, you know, straight from the Fed. That was really unique. But it was very challenging because the recruiting pipeline completely dried up. Unlike during the COVID crisis, there was no liquidity in markets. So no deals were getting done. You know, finance as a whole ground to a halt. So for a lot of people, and obviously a lot of firms just frankly disappeared in that time. I remember very well being on, on a rugby trip the day Bear Stearns collapsed. And our captain had an internship there. And so, you know, all of a sudden, and this is sort of late March 2008, thrust into a position where, you know, what thought he was going to be doing that summer was no longer there. So it was very challenging. And again, it's sort of, how did you work through that? I go back to my response to the previous question, which is, you've got to do your own work at that point. You have to seek out opportunities. You have to leverage your network. And you have to aim high, low, and everywhere in between to find an opportunity. In the summer of 2008, they were few and far between. And coming out of the crisis, you know, I'm fortunate in that I had prior investment banking experience, so I was able to get a role in investment banking in 2009. But it was not easy or a given at all.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And you then worked your way all the way up to managing director. What do you think was the key to getting all those promotions?
So at every level of investment banking, the role changes pretty significantly in a lot of cases. When you start as an analyst, you are doing the blocking and tackling, you are building the models, you're putting together the PowerPoint presentations, you're running the data room. There's a whole slew of tasks that you are in charge of. And then once you have mastered those, you are now a really good analyst. And then to become an associate, you now need to be showing that you can be mentoring analysts on that role, right? And then as soon as you're mentoring analysts on that role and you're kind of working at the next level, which is, okay, I'm not the person building the model now, I'm the person reviewing the model, I'm the person reviewing the deck or frankly, actually, you know, putting the deck together, coming up with the outline. Now you're ready to be an associate, you know, and then once you are at the level where you are leading deals, where you're quarterbacking the deals on the ground and making sure that all the work streams are moving forward. Now you're working at the VP level, and then you're ready for that promotion. You need to be working at the next level to get the promotion. And again, at every step, you know, the role changes pretty significantly. I think the biggest place where it changes is frankly that ED to MD level, where all of a sudden, you need to basically strike out on your own and show that you can originate transactions and get them over the finish line. And those are really the key responsibilities of my current position, right? As a managing director, whether you're in a product group or an industry group, I'm in a product group, I sit in M&A, you know, your role is to help originate transactions. And if you're not the primary relationship on the the client doing the transaction, which is fine. Then you need to be the person that is indispensable to that deal, right? That your industry partner says, you know, we wouldn't have won this deal if it wasn't for Elliot or Matthias or Emil, right? And then you're ready. Then you're originating. But originating is only half the battle, right? You need to execute, and that means it's great to win all these deals, but you have to get them over the finish line. You've got to get them signed and then closed, and that's a whole other capability set, right? There's all the key steps that you go through in a transaction. You know, if you take a standard sell side from, you know, preparing the confidential information memorandum, running the data room, but where the rubber meets the road is, you know, the last couple of weeks negotiating the deal, working through the issues that always pop up in every single deal. You know, deals are not easy to do. So what are to be able to see those issues, anticipate them, and then help provide solutions to bridge gaps and ultimately get to a successful transaction. Those are the key responsibilities of the managing director.
That makes sense. Now moving on to the market segment. What do you make of the current M&A environment in the hospitality and leisure sectors, and where do you see it going in the near future?
Okay, so the first thing I would say is that it's just describing hospitality and leisure. It's a very broad sector, right? I mean, leisure can kind of encompass everything you do when you're not in the office, right? And that includes some of the traditional verticals that, you know, Mollis and me as part of Mollis have done deals in, like skiing and golf, hotels, but there's a lot of other things that go into it as well, you know, like events. I would say one real change that happened coming, you know, through the COVID crisis is that people focused more on leisure and wanted to, you know, maximize their time outside of the office. So there's been a pretty good tailwind overall for the sector. I'd say the same thing with hospitality. And, you know, you've seen people really say, first there was the whole revenge vacation phenomenon, which sort of to a large extent is over, but people really are focused on, you know, maximizing their vacation time and really having great experiences, right? You never hear anybody say, hey, 20 years ago, I had this great job, this great day at the office. But you do hear people say, 20 years ago, I went on a great vacation, right? So in general, there is a tailwind for the industry, and it's been particularly good for leisure. You know, within hospitality, the industry kind of breaks down in a couple of different ways. So on the one hand, you have the real estate, right? And the other hand, you have the brand companies. You know, they're putting the flag up on the hotel that you're staying at, and you have management companies that actually manage the hotels. On the real estate side, it's been a challenged market for a couple of years because interest rates have been so high. With interest rates coming down last month, and we expect them to continue going down going forward, I think that'll really loosen up that market. I expect a lot more transactions in 2025 in the real estate side than we've had, you know, really since 21 was the last good year. On the asset light side, so the non-real estate side, and this is the brand companies and the management companies, it's been a pretty strong market the last couple of years. Mollis, we've advised on a number of transactions in the brand space. Most recently, we advised Hyatt. They acquired Standard International, which owns, you know, the Standard and Bunkhouse brands. We've done a lot in the hotel management space. We signed up three transactions in that sector this year. These are businesses which, again, real estate is trading. It helps them. But they're not dependent on it. And they're able to continue growing even when there isn't a strong real estate M&A market. So we would expect that to continue as well. I mean, lower interest rates just overall are going to be good for the M&A market.
You touched a bit about your industry during 2020. So I imagine there were a lot of opportunities for strategic buyers during that time.
So in 2020, I would say a little less so. You have to remember, and we go back to the mindset of 2020, March 2020, April 2020, no one really knew what was going to go on. And there was, and everyone was scared, right? It was a very challenging time. We didn't know how long this, you know, the COVID crisis was going to last. In our role as investment bankers, and I would say what we are is advisors. We are advisors to corporations. The best thing we could do in that time was pick up the phone, talk to our clients, you know, let them know what's going on in the industry, let them know, frankly, what are other people in the industry doing, because everyone was sharing best practices then. It was really about survival in those early years. Again, I would go back, I'd come back to the intersection of finance and public policy, let them know what's going on in Washington and how we think that might affect them. And so, and no one was really focused on doing deals then, right? The goal in that time, because you didn't know how long it was going to last, was preservation of liquidity, right? So, you know, keep your cash, keep your lines of credit. No one was going to spend money in that time. Now, coming out of that, in 2021, but then became the greatest year of M&A on record in the United States and globally, because you had an environment where there was a strong rebound in the economy. Rates were still incredibly low. And all these companies that had preserved cash for a year and now are seeing the economy rebound then had cash to deploy into transactions. So you know, it was a great learning experience for me, and a great opportunity to just get much closer with all your clients, and because everybody just wanted to talk and kind of work through it, you know, like that old slogan from COVID, like, we're all in this together. It really applied, right? And you know, coming out of that, I would say our franchise and hospitality and our relationships are much, much stronger.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And cross-border M&A has been significant in hospitalities, with firm expanding into emerging markets. How do you assess the risk and opportunities when advising clients on international deals, especially in regions like Asia and Middle East?
So, you know, Moelis is an international firm. We have 23 offices around the world. I believe we have the largest presence in the Middle East. So I think the first thing you can say is, you know, when you're doing an international deal, and you're right, you need to assess the risks and the opportunities. And the opportunities, obviously, are that these markets are growing very, very fast. So there's a real opportunity to grow in them. But there's often preconceived notions about some of these markets, right? And if you take the Middle East as an example, you know, it's a great opportunity to educate, to put them on the phone with our professionals in the Middle East, and so they can really learn about it from the people that are on the ground and that have been, you know, critical to developing that market for 20 plus years. You know, we have the strongest presence of any firm in Saudi Arabia, as an example, which is committed to growing its domestic market pretty substantially. The best thing we can do is, and they have, you know, I would say our professionals have unrivaled access to leaders and decision makers in that part of the world. So the best thing we can do is, you know, put clients on the phone with our team in the Middle East and let them hear firsthand, you know, what's going on, right? And let them talk about the opportunities and the risks. Look, different markets also at various times in history are more or less attractive, right? Obviously, right now, people are very focused on, you know, the risks of China. And again, we have a team on the ground in China as well as one in Hong Kong. They can speak specifically to the challenges there and help them think through in investing in that market.
Can you walk us through unique characteristics of the leisure and hospitality sectors?
Sure. I mean, we touched on it a little bit at the outset, but it's a very dynamic industry as well. It is, if you think of hospitality and leisure, it's kind of everything that people do when they're not in the office. So, you know, it's how do you create experiences that are authentic for people, that they're going to enjoy that time. It's intangible, right? It's not like, you know, buying a toy. It's about giving people experiences. And another thing I would say is that it touches a lot of other sectors, right? I mean, we talked about real estate, food and beverage, technology, right? I mean, how is technology impacting leisure and hospitality? And sustainability now is a very important part of this sector. And, you know, you hear about it this summer, there was, you know, Europeans are saying, hey, there's over-tourism in this part of the world, right? So how do you create authentic, sustainable experiences for people? It's not dissimilar to investment banking in that it's a customer-facing industry, right? And so what is the best way you can deliver that experience? And you know, one of the things I like about working in it is, or working with professionals in the hospitality sector, is they're constantly thinking about, like, how do I give my guests the best experience, right? You know, that to make people happy. So it's a very rewarding sector to work in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we touched on some of the deals. I think we talked about Hyatt earlier. Could you share a recent transaction that yourself or Amulius has advised on, or just walk us through the typical steps involved in making a deal happen?
Sure. Well, I think the Hyatt Standard deal is a very interesting one. It just closed earlier this week. You know, Hyatt is obviously very focused on building their lifestyle hospitality offering. You know, last year we advised them they acquired Dream. Standard is a slightly different offering. So that's one where it's, again, understanding, you know, how are people traveling? Where do they want to stay? What type of experiences do they want? And helping Hyatt build a portfolio that addresses those customer needs. I think another transaction that I recently worked on, which was, you know, again, very rewarding, we advised Sonder. Sonder is another hospitality company focused on apartment rental segment and hotels. And we advised them. They did a strategic partnership with Marriott. Helped them raise capital, and we helped them, you know, manage their balance sheet. So that was a transaction that took into, you know, if you think of what Moelis does, capital structure advisory, capital raising, M&A, and industry expertise. So really combined all of the, you know, all of the core products that Moelis offered to deliver for a client and put them on a path forward to sustainable, profitable growth.
Thank you for sharing this. To close this market segment, is there any trends or practices you're most excited for or looking forward to 2024 or beyond?
Yeah, I think there are. And again, it's part of the hospitality industry. Challenge is to constantly stay, you know, at the front of the curve of where is the market going. And what I would tell you is that, you know, Gen Z travels differently than, you know, than their parents did or their grandparents did. And so understanding what are the experiences the millennials and Gen Z are looking for, right? And they're not the same as they were in the past. I think wellness has a much stronger importance than it has in the past. Experiential travel, cultural immersion, these are attributes of travel that the younger generation is looking for. And so how can companies respond to sort of meet those growing needs? What type of accommodations do people like to stay in, right? I think 20 years ago, it would be unheard of if I told you that there's such a thing called glamping, where people pay to effectively stay in a fancy tent, right? But that is about meeting the needs and to use a hockey expression, because you guys are from Montreal, skating to where the puck is, right? So I think that's one big component that we need to think about going forward in the sectors that I cover. The other one is technology, right? How will technology continue to transform this industry as it has, frankly, every other industry? And you might even argue the hospitality has been, not as advanced as some other industries in that regard, and that it's still very much a person-to-person, you know, face-to-face type of industry, right? And people don't want to lose that, though. That's authentic. So how do we work technology in to make, you know, the delivery of products and services, you know, more seamless and better while still maintaining that, you know, that human interaction?
Moving on to our mentorship segment, we touched on it a little bit through your experience, but how do you think students should go about getting that first internship in investment banking?
So look, I would say the number one thing, first of all, you got to leverage, like I said, even for myself in the past, think of all of the ways that you can get an internship. You can start on campus. That's obviously one of them. So, you know, I know you guys are sort of right at the start of the recruiting process. Make sure you go to every, you know, to every bank's presentation. Make sure you talk to as many people as you can. But you can't stop there, right? You can't assume that you're going to, you know, get an internship out of the on-campus process. So I would say, you know, leverage your network, your personal network, your school network, send emails, reach out, try to have as many coffee chats as possible. Really understand what the role is, how the firms are differentiated, right? So that when you speak in interviews, you know exactly how to answer that type of question, because it always comes up: what differentiates Moelis from our competitors? So I think you need to really treat it almost like I have five classes this year, but actually I have six classes, and getting that summer internship is as important. Dedicate hours every single week to focusing on it, to doing the reach out, to doing your research, and preparation, right? Because everybody that you're competing against is going to be just as A-type, just as qualified as you. So you need to be incredibly prepared for those interviews.
So once you're at the interview process at Moelis, what does an interview look like?
Well, so I think you start with, typically you start with sort of an on-campus first round interview. There will be, a component, a technical component, and a personality social component. Again, I think there's very good resources online now that you can find to sort of understand what type of questions you're going to be getting. But I would tell you, I think the interview, starts long before you sit in the room with somebody. I think you should treat every interaction, you know, with anybody you meet at a firm as an interview, right? And by the way, that's exactly the way I think about it, meeting clients, right? Every interaction is an interview. It's an opportunity to prove yourself or to fall flat on your face, right? So for every time you meet somebody, be prepared, do the work, read up on their bio, anticipate what questions you're going to be getting, and prepare accordingly. Make sure you know your own sales pitch, right? The first question in any interview, regardless of industry, is going to be, why should we hire you, right? There's no excuse to not have an answer to that. In finance, I think you know what types of questions are going to come when it comes to technical, right? Someone asks you what a DCF is, you know, you got to know what a DCF is. And saying, well, we haven't learned that yet, that's not an excuse, because I promise you the other person has gone and done the research online and learned what a DCF is. So make sure that you are prepared and ready for those interviews.
Yeah, that makes sense. And once someone has that internship, how should they go about differentiating themselves from other summer analysts to secure that return offer?
So first of all, I think you shouldn't think of it as a me or them type of opportunity. Our objective, and I believe we did this year at Moelis, is I think we offered everybody return offers, or the goal is to offer everybody return offers, right? We're not trying to fill a certain number of seats. We want you to succeed, right? And we're going to give you all the tools you have to succeed. But you also have to take on that responsibility. And again, I think a summer internship is like a 10-week interview, right? Come every day and treat that day, like it's an interview, right? And prepare accordingly. I would say you know, take notes, take lots of notes. Everyone knows when you're starting out in this job, it's like drinking out of a fire hose. You're going to make mistakes, but, you know, you can eliminate repeat mistakes by learning from them, right? And the best way to do that is take notes and at the end of the day, review all your notes. Prepare. You should be very proficient in Excel before you get to the seat in a summer internship, right? I would take time to work on models on your own. Work on models with friends, work on models with other upperclassmen, so that you come and you already know the basic tools that you're going to be using, right? Every university these days has access to these tools, things like Bloomberg and Capital IQ. Like, be proficient in them so that you can hit the ground running and make a difference on day one. And then attitude. Attitude is so important. You want to be helpful, humble, but also you want to show, you know, what you're capable of, right? So, you know, I always go back to, you want to try to be the first person in, the last person to leave. Make sure that the people you're working with can rely on you, and that you're there, right? And that you're there, and that you are a safe pair of hands throughout the summer and obviously beyond.
Yeah, that makes sense. What skills are necessary to excel in investment banking? And how does it differ as you get promoted?
Yeah, so again, we sort of talked a little bit about this at the outset, but every step of the journey in investment banking, the skill set does change. At the outset, certainly the technical skills are incredibly important, right? Excel, PowerPoint, et cetera. I think what's maybe understated is the importance of communication. And again, going back to the summer internship, you need to be constantly communicating to all of your deal teams what you're working on, what your timing is. One thing that I can tell you frustrates people is if you are working on a task and they don't hear from you for a really long time. So just get in the habit of sending an email and saying, hey, this is going really well. We did this, this, and this. Next, we need to do this and this. Anticipated timing is XYZ, right? Just let people know kind of what's going on. You're going to have multiple deal teams, and all of them have deadlines. So understand, like, what the priority is. Ask questions. Okay, when do we need this by? Is there a part of the, you know, can we do part of this and not all of this right away? So that you can manage your multiple deal teams. What you don't want is after the fact having to say, well, I had to work on something else. Like, you have to get ahead of those. And I would also encourage everyone to just pick up the phone, right? Don't assume that if you sent an email or a text message that they saw it, right? Pick up the phone, talk to people, and let them know firsthand. You know, sometimes there could be, you know, literally hundreds of emails in a day. They might have missed that email. But if you pick up the phone and talk to them, you know, they didn't miss that. So communicate, communicate, communicate. I always say you cannot over-communicate in this profession.
Yeah, thank you. And now moving on to the rapid-fire questions. What is the best piece of advice that Anwar's ever given you?
You never stop learning. Right. Never assume you know everything. Every day that you come to this job, you are going to learn something new. And so never stop learning.
How would you describe a career in one word?
It's pretty tough to narrow down to one word, but I would say blessed. It's an honor and a privilege to work in this profession every day.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA is as a student?
Look, the reality is it's very important. I'm gonna put it at 8, but it's not everything, right? The rest of the resume really matters as well. Your extracurriculars matter, and people understand there is a balance, right? If you have a lower GPA, but you were the star athlete on a varsity team, you know, people understand the time commitment of that.
If you wouldn't be in the financial industry, what would you be doing instead?
Well, if I I probably, again, would still be in finance, but if I wasn't working in investment banking, I would say, real estate or hospitality, right? There's a reason why I focused on this sector. I love working in the sector and I love working with people and trying to help create experiences.
And what is one book you would recommend to our listeners?
All right. So I can't narrow down to just one, but I think for people that are going through college right now, I would say the most important thing is to sort of understand what's happened in the last decade and really, frankly, 5 decades in finance. If they want to do this type of professional, I would start with Too Big to Fail by Andrew Ross Sorkin and The Big Short by Michael Lewis, which I think are very insightful on the last crisis. And then there's a number of books, that they should go further back. They want to understand kind of how current investment banking and private equity came to be, books like Barbarians at the Gates.
All right. Well, that closes it for this episode. So thank you for being so generous with your time, Ilya.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed the show, don't hesitate to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Take care, guys, and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management or any other field in financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for your given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive products. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.